Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is academic and author Richard Bronowski. Richard is also a retired Australian diplomat. After junior postings in Tokyo, Rangoon and Tehran, he was deputy chief of mission in the Australian Embassy in Manila. Over the years, he's held positions as the Australian ambassador to Vietnam, Republic of Korea, and to Mexico, the Central American Republics, and Cuba. He took time out from diplomacy to be the general manager of Radio Australia in the early 1990s. Now he's an adjunct professor in media and communications at the University of Sydney. He's the author of three books, with a fourth due to appear this October on the nuclear disaster at Fukushima and its implications for Japan and the international nuclear industry. Richard Bronowski joins me now on the line. Welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you, Helen.
In the interests of all things, what's the word I'm looking for? I must say that Richard is my brother, just so that everybody knows. Now, Richard, I'm very interested, and many of our listeners will be, about the situation in North Korea. I think I'd like you to outline the history of North Korea, why the two Koreas are separate. How did that take place?
All right, Helen, I can do that. It really goes back to the end of the Second World War, when the Soviet Union declared war on Japan right at the tail end of the war, just before America dropped two atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the Russian army swept into, the Red Army swept into Mongolia, and it was coming down into the Korean Peninsula. At this stage, the United States military was engaged fully in Okinawa, and they just mopped up that island, and they were drawing breath before they went on to Japan and to Korea. And they realized sort of very late in the stage that Korea was quite important to them, so they wanted to at least retain a foothold and not let the Soviets take over the whole of the peninsula. So they sent two young officers, one of whom was Dean Rusk, who later became Secretary of State, in the War Office in Washington, into a room and instructed them to work out overnight where the line should be drawn in the sand to stop the Soviet Union going any further. And they chose the 38th parallel. Why? Because it allowed Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, to remain on the northern side in the Russian zone, and for Seoul to stay in the south, to be the capital of South Korea. So it had nothing to do with the Koreans. The Koreans had nothing to do with the division of their country. It was all an American ploy to stop the Soviets from coming down to the south. The Soviets respected that line because they didn't know whether America had another atom bomb that they might drop on them. So they kind of did it. Then after that, the Soviet Union more or less appointed or confirmed the presidency of North Korea to Kim Il-sung, who had been a freedom fighter against the Japanese during the war, and the Americans gave the presidency in the southern part of the peninsula to Syngman Rhee, or Yi Syngman, who hardly had been, he was a septuagenarian at that stage, he was a Christian, he was living in America. He came in and took over. Now, both these leaders were very authoritarian, so there was no democracy in either North or South. What happened between 1945 and 1950 is a state of perpetual civil war in the southern part of the peninsula. The Soviet Union and Kim Il-sung had the north pretty well wrapped up, so there wasn't much grounds for dissension. But in the south, there was a huge battles going on, and Syngman Rhee was absolutely ruthless with anyone he thought was either communist or socialist or of any kind of persuasion that was against him. And to add insult to injury, the Americans kept some of the Japanese occupying army, the much-hated Japanese colonialists, in South Korea as guards, and this was a huge insult to the Koreans. Anyway, across the 38th parallel between those years, 45 and 50, there were a lot of attacks both by the southerners into the north, initiated by Syngman Rhee, and from the north into the south. And it wasn't until June 1950 when the North Koreans really became fair dinkum and decided they wanted to take the south that they came over in strength. So that's kind of the history, if you like. And it's a very, very sad story. As we know what happened after that, that the North Koreans came right down to Busan in the southeast corner of the peninsula. General MacArthur, in a brilliant stroke, landed troops at Incheon up on the northwestern side, and in a pincer movement defeated the North Koreans and drove them back into North Korea. Then the rather silly man went right up to the Yellow River on the Chinese border and ran into the biggest military ambush in military history, when the Chinese had sent volunteers into the northern part of Korea and they attacked the Americans and drove them back into the south. And between there and 1954, 53, there was a seesaw between the two sides, and Seoul changed hands a number of times, and it became a war of attrition, a bit like the First World War. It was trench warfare. It was very unpopular in the United States, and eventually there was an armistice, but there's never been a peace. And so ever since then, we've got a situation which is very tense on the Korean Peninsula.
Now, why initially did America, just at the end of the Second World War, think that the Korean Peninsula was valuable to them?
Because they thought, they were worried about the Soviet Union. They're also worried about China because, of course, the communists took over in China in 1949, defeated Syngman Rhee, defeated Chiang Kai-shek and sent him off to Taiwan. And the Americans wanted to contain China, just as they appear to be doing today.
Okay, and why did North Korea invade South Korea? What were the dynamics
There was constant warfare going on along the 38th parallel. The North Koreans felt provoked by the South. They felt that that Syngman Rhee was a puppet of the Americans.
Which he was.
They wanted to take over the whole peninsula and turn it into a socialist state. And Kim Il-sung was very widely regarded in the whole of the Korean Peninsula as a hero of the resistance against the Japanese, something Syngman Rhee couldn't claim. Mm. So, yes, they certainly had designs to take over the whole thing. The Chinese, who were the backers of the North Koreans after the Soviets pulled out in 48-49, the Chinese were their mentors, and they were very nervous when the American forces came up to the Yalu River. They were so-called United Nations forces, but of course, like all these UN operations post-war, they were initiated by and mainly trooped by American forces.
Mm. Okay, so that gives a bit of background. Now, bring us up to the present. How come North Korea has been virtually a police state? Number one, and people in concentration camps. Number two, starvation, tremendous starvation. What has evolved since Syngman Rhee was in control
in South Korea? What's happened, Helen, is that North Korea at first, during the 1950s and even into the 1960s, had a more vibrant economy than South Korea. They had minerals, they had coal, they had energy, and they had a grand plan. They were nominally communist, but that's a rather tricky term to use. The fact is that North Korea has evolved into a military state and really into a monarchy. Kim Il-sung became the king. His son, Kim Jong-il, became the successor. Now Kim Jong-un, his son, is the third in line. And so you've got a kind of a monarchy. Now, I think there's a lot of black propaganda about North Korea. Of course, it would be a terrible place to have to live. They are very authoritarian and they do lock up political prisoners. But a lot of this starvation one hears about is due to a number of very inclement seasons. The North Koreans have got a doctrine called Juche, which is self-sufficiency. They want to do everything by themselves, and they've pushed this through against enormous odds. So you can't say that, you know, that Kim Jong-un sits in his palace and indulges himself with the best food and wine and so on and lets the peasants starve. That's far too simplistic and far wrong. I think that it's a very authoritarian state, but what makes it so, and I'd like to emphasize this point, is the enormous threat they feel from the United States. Every year, and I was ambassador there from 1987 to 89 during the Olympic Games of 1988, every year the United States has a huge military combined exercise with South Korean Marines and Army and Navy and Air Force in the southern part of the peninsula. And every time that happens, and it is in fact an exercise of taking over North Korea, of attacking North Korea, and the North Koreans see it that way, and they feel an enormous sense of threat. Don't forget that during the Korean War, the North Koreans were bombed flat. There wasn't one stone standing on another. The Americans got sick of having to keep targeting targets that they'd already bombed flat before.
Dear.
It was just a complete devastation.
Dear.
And the North Koreans feel a terrible sense of threat from the Americans.
Yes, and I've read that what the North Koreans want from the Americans is for them to sign a non-aggression treaty that they will not be attacked by America, number one. And number two, they want food. Is that accurate?
Pretty accurate. They want a peace treaty. They want guarantees from the United States that they won't try to attempt a regime change, number one. And number two, they want freedom to international markets. They want to get rid of the economic
sanctions,
just like the Cubans do. And if North Korea could have that, and if the United States stopped treating them like a naughty little boy that needed to be punished, I think the North Koreans would respond. They have responded in the past, and they could continue to respond in a much more positive way. It's a matter of drawing them out. And throughout my diplomatic career, I've always had the feeling that negotiations is the way to go, not threats.
Mm.
People don't respond to threats, or rather they respond by becoming more aggressive than they were before. And that's precisely what's happened in North Korea. They feel under siege.
Well, why won't America, for God's sake, do that? Why won't
you might as well ask, why does America continue to have a siege mentality about Cuba too? Why do they continue to punish Cuba? I think there's a certain emotional immaturity in this. I think it's part of the hubristic characteristic of a superpower. They feel they can dictate everything, and they'll continue to do so. And that's what they've done in Cuba, and that's what they've done that in Iraq. They've done it in Afghanistan, and I think they're doing it continue to do it in North Korea. The North Koreans are very tough people, and they're not going to put up with that. Quite frankly, the South Koreans have often been concerned about the unrepentant attitude of both the Japanese and the United States towards North Korea. One thing the South Koreans do not want is another war on their peninsula.
Mm.
One thing that South Koreans do want is for peace to continue.
Mm.
They're not particularly concerned about reconciliation and reunification. That may or may not come later on.
Mm.
What they want to do is get on with their own lives, and they've got a very wealthy economy now, a very successful economy, and they simply want to get on with competing economically with the Japanese, which they're doing very successfully.
Well, I've read too that, you know, the Pentagon plays war games a lot.
Yes.
And one of the most common war games that is played in the Pentagon is if North Korea invades South Korea, and almost always the war game ends up in global nuclear war. Do you know about that?
I wouldn't be surprised, but I do know that the war games, as I mentioned earlier, include this annual exercise, which used to be called Exercise Team Spirit.
Mm.
I was very puzzled that the Americans were having a joint military exercise with South Korea just before the 1988 Seoul Olympics. And I said, why do you do this? This is going to raise the temperature along the border, and you're going to have all these North Korean artillery vectored in on Seoul, which is not the thing you want for the Olympic Games. And Jim sort of shrugged a bit and said, yeah, well, you're quite right. But he said, unfortunately, State Department doesn't really have much of a a say on this, and I don't as an ambassador. This is a Pentagon matter. This is their playground. They're going to continue to have it, and they don't want to be circumscribed by diplomatic considerations like the State Department would offer.
Their playground, eh? Okay, well, let's move on to the nuclear situation in North Korea. Would you like to give us a history of that, Richard Brunowski,
yes, very
and
quickly.
Where it is now?
Yes, Helen, I will. Look, we have to go back to the 1994 framework. Jimmy Carter went into North Korea on behalf of President Bill Clinton in the early 90s to try to stop the North Koreans from going ahead with their nuclear program. We discovered that the North Koreans had a nuclear program during my watch as Australian ambassador in South Korea at Yongbyon. They had a reactor and they were deliberately irradiating nuclear fuel to produce plutonium for a weapon. So Jim was very concerned about this, and Bill Clinton almost came to war at that time, but he sent Jimmy Carter to North Korea, and he brokered a brilliant agreement. It's called the 1994 Framework, under which the United States, Japan, South Korea, China, and the Soviet, and Russia would guarantee an arrangement whereby the North Koreans would be given bunker oil for fuel until the United States and Japan and South Korea had built two Westinghouse 600 megawatt nuclear reactors for North Korean electricity. And this was meant to obviate the or to contradict or to confound the excuse that the North Koreans were saying that they wanted nuclear power for electricity purpose, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Koreans agreed with that. Now, for a number of years, between 1994 and, say, 1998-99, the North Koreans allowed American nuclear engineers to come in and inspect their equipment. They allowed them to come in and take the very dangerous fuel elements out of that small reactor that the North Koreans had built themselves, and to stabilize them and reprocess them and keep them and separate the plutonium and the uranium from the actinides, the waste. And this, you know, this was going pretty well, but what happened was that the American Senate, the Foreign Affairs Committee, under the chairmanship of Jesse Helms, was saying we shouldn't reward bad behaviour, and he was obdurate. He was very much against providing nuclear reactors to North Korea. So after about 6 or 7 years of the framework, the North Koreans gradually realized that the Americans were not going to honor their part of the agreement. They were not going to put in two nuclear reactors in North Korea. So they virtually said, well, look, we're going to walk away from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We're going to restart our reactor at Yongbyon because you're not helping us and you are not acting in good faith. So that's what happened. Now, ever since then, there's been, as we know, there have been two nuclear tests in North Korea in the late decade of the 21st century. They've also been testing missiles and rockets. They say to launch satellites, but of course it's a dual technology. And there are swings and roundabouts here. Now, what they need to do is sit down in these six-party talks, the six countries I mentioned, and work out an arrangement which gets them back to the 1994 framework arrangement. If that could happen, I think that the North Koreans could be persuaded to abandon their nuclear program. Others say no. They say, look, they've gone too far. They've got weapons now. They don't have a delivery system. They haven't miniaturized their weapons, but they could use them. And, of course, the North Koreans look at India and Pakistan and Israel, for goodness sake, and they say, well, they've got nuclear weapons, and they stop regime change or invasion of their countries. We're going to do the same. And, of course, that's what's happening.
Wouldn't you have thought that President Obama, intelligent as he is and concerned deeply about lateral proliferation of nuclear weapons and indeed a nuclear war between Russia and America. Wouldn't you have thought that he would be able to manage to get back to the 1994 agreement brokered by Jimmy Carter?
I've been very disappointed with President Obama's foreign affairs performance, very disappointed indeed, over the continuation of the war in Afghanistan, over the so-called war on terrorism. And yes, I'm disappointed that this hasn't occurred. It seems to me that in his first term, he's been circumscribed very much by Congress and by the Republicans, and he's feeling very defensive about that. And any sign he gives of weakness, you know, they're going to attack him for it. I only hope two things. One is that he gets re-elected, and B, in his second term, he's going to show less constraints and not stop looking over his shoulder at the Conservatives and the Tea Party and go ahead and do some imaginative things, including having direct bilateral discussions with North Korea, which they have been doing surreptitiously, but have them more openly and lead to some kind of modus operandi. That's what I hope will happen.
Yeah, I agree. All right, now, the next thing is that you, Richard Broinowski, were a foreign affairs diplomat in Tehran, in Iran, way, way, way back.
Yes, in 1972-73, that's right.
That's right, and I visited you there. So I'd like you, please, to give us the history of Iran and bring us up to date now about its nuclear program and what everyone is very worried about. So this is a fairly long discussion. Would you like to introduce us to Iran?
I will, Helen. I'd like to keep it as summarized as I can,
yes,
as compact as I can. We have to go right back to when Iran was the great Persian Empire under Cyrus, under Artaxerxes and Xerxes, under the great leaders of the past. And it was an empire. The Persian Empire spread right across Mesopotamia into the Mediterranean. It wasn't until Alexander the Great came and attacked them that they were reduced again. But the Persians have a sense of their own greatness and a sense of their own history. They fiercely reject being described as Arabs. They're not Arabs. They say we are Persians. We are a separate race. They've got enormous heritage of culture. The poet Ferdowsi, the wonderful music, the wonderful poetry of the Persians is still alive and well. Now, bring us up to the 20th century. Iran, of course, contracted from its empire status into the present country. It's still an enormous country. It's about four times bigger than France. And it's surrounded by Arab states in the west and in the south, and Afghanistan in the east, and China to the northeast, and the Soviet Union or Russia across the Caspian, and all those other states, Belarus and so on, up in the northwest. So it's in a very unstable situation. In 1954, but it's also been a colonial plaything of the great powers, the French, the English, and later on the United States. And there was a tremendous amount of exploitation of Iran when the oil was discovered there by an Australian, incidentally, an Australian geologist back in the 19th century. And developed from that was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And that company was really a British company, and it was exploitative and took the oil and gave minimum royalties to the Persians. Now, in 1954, the Iranians managed, for the first time in the history of their own country, but also the first time among all their neighboring countries, except Israel, to have a democratic election in which they elected a leader called Mossadegh. And Mossadegh was very popular. He was a bit of a poet himself, a philosopher in the early 50s. Now, he wanted to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and set about doing it. The British didn't want this to happen, and so they persuaded the Americans, the CIA, under Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles's brother, to stage a coup in Tehran. So he got a whole lot of money and hired a lot of thugs in the street, made it appear that Mossadegh was a communist, a socialist, a bad man, and he got these hired thugs to go around beating up people and saying, we want democracy. So they got rid of him. Mossadegh was in prison and he later died. And they put back in power the Shah, the son of the great Shah of the 19th century, and the Shah and Shah Aryameh, and he came back into power. Now, when I was posted in Tehran in the early 70s, there was a great feeling you got when you walked around the bazaars that everyone loved the Shah and the Shah Banu, his beautiful young second wife, who was a feminist, and their children. And everywhere you went in the bazaar, there were photographs of the Shah and the Shah Banu. But the fact was that they hated him, and they hated the Americans for having put him back in power. He was not a Democrat. He was, in his own way, trying to bring the country into the 20th century, but he was also spending an enormous amount of money on weapons. Yeah. He had a paranoia about the Soviet Union attacking Iran, and he was getting enormous quantity of weapons from Britain and the United States and France. Jet fighters and tanks and guns and ships.
And the Americans were helping him build, or wanted to build, nuclear reactors.
Yes, that was under Atoms for Peace, Eisenhower's program. I mean, it wasn't just Iran, though, doing that too. But yes, the Shah had grandiose plans to put about 6 or 8 large nuclear reactors along the Persian Gulf. You never called it the Arabian Gulf, then you had to call it the Persian Gulf, or you'd be chucked out of Tehran. You'd be declared persona non grata. And he had these plans, and he was building one. He also had a nuclear research establishment at the University of Tehran in Tehran, and he had other plants in Isfahan and Shiraz, I think it was, and Natanz. And, he had a very ambitious program. I've no doubt that he would have wanted to go nuclear and have nuclear weapons too if he'd been allowed to.
Yeah, yeah.
But before that happened, of course, in 1979, he was turfed out by rising anger among the predominantly Shia Muslims in Iran, who are far more religious than anyone knew or suspected. It was very ironic that the Americans, the French and the British had enormously strong secret service intelligence operations out of their embassies in Tehran, but none of them, and we didn't either, suspect that how widely hated the Shah was. So when the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was fulminating and stirring in France, came back in 79. The Shah, who is now a sick man, he fled. He just left. And there's a wonderful book written by this period by my friend Bill Sullivan, who was the last United States ambassador to Tehran, a lovely man. And he had a very thorough professional idea, and he kept warning Zbigniew Brzezinski and Cyrus Vance and Jimmy Carter that we have to cut our losses and stop supporting the Shah and try to find moderate elements in this new Islamic revolutionary movement that we can support. Otherwise, our interest in Iran will vanish. And Jimmy Carter just didn't accept this, and Cyrus Vance told him to get on with his job, and Zbigniew Brzezinski was quite rude about him. And instead of resigning on the spot, which I would have done, I think, he stayed in Tehran as the American ambassador because there were about 3,000 American families associated with all the weapons industries, Bell helicopters and so on, and he didn't want to cut and run because that might have induced panic among the Americans in Iran. So he stayed until the denouement happened. In 79, the embassy was machine gunned. He was marched out at the point of a bayonet by a revolutionary guard, the United States ambassador, there he was, and the Americans were held captive until that abortive attack by Jimmy Carter with helicopters that ended in tears in the desert, and only later did all these get repatriated. So from this became a very dramatic and bitter lesson for the American bureaucracy and officialdom, and they've never forgiven the Iranians for doing that. So it's a bit like Cuba, it's a bit like Korea, it's a bit like Vietnam, although the Americans are getting on very well with the Vietnamese now. In Iran, the indelible elements are the overthrow of Mossadegh, a mm-hmm. democratically elected leader.
And much loved, too.
And much loved by certain people, not everyone. And the American experience of having their embassy machine gunned and their ambassador taken away, it was very degrading for them. So, yeah, ever since then, there's been suspicion and animosity, and there's no American embassy there now, and it's just a tragedy that this all this has happened.
Right. Well, that's a good political background. Now let's move into the nuclear issue that is on everyone's minds and particularly Israel's minds. Would you like to outline that, Richard Bronowski?
Well, my feeling about that, Helen, is that if the Iranians are bent on developing nuclear weapons, A, that hasn't been proven, and B, they're still a long way off it. And American intelligence reports support that view, that it's still 4 or 5 years away. They have extensive uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz and other places, underground a lot of them. They're enriching uranium-235, but only up to 20%, which is enough for some of their research reactors. Mind you, they have a fleet of small reactors in Iran already, small ones, and they've got one power-generating one at Bushehr on the Gulf.
Which is a Russian reactor.
Which was begun by the Germans, but was finished by the Russians. It's not a Russian reactor, but they've helped finish it.
Right.
Now, but I get very concerned about the attitude of Jerusalem. I get very concerned about the right-wing leaders, including Netanyahu in Israel, that say ineluctably that Iran is developing the bomb, and secondly, that once they get it, they're going to attack Israel. That's just, I think, absolute fantasy. A, that they've got the bomb or getting it, and B, that once they do, they're going to launch an attack on Israel. What a stupid thing to suggest. That would mean the end of Iran, because the Israelis would retaliate with a massive nuclear strike of their own. Why would they do that? The reason, like everyone else, every other nation that has nuclear weapons, is for deterrence. And when you look at Iran, they're surrounded by China and Russia and India and Pakistan and Israel, all with nuclear weapons. So why on earth should they not have them themselves? And when we hear news story after news story coming from the West that the Western world is concerned about Iran going nuclear, no, it's not the Western world. It's the United States and Britain, and to some extent France, who are coerced into feeling this anxiety as well, all to a certain extent led by Israel. And it seems to me that a very, very dangerous thing, because I don't think Israel has the military capacity to take out the nuclear facilities from Iran. And if it did happen, there'd be massive destabilization and warfare in the Middle East. And it's something that should not be able to happen. And this is something else that President Barack Obama should be, in my view, leaning much more heavily on the Israelis than he's doing to stop this happening. And even some senior Israeli retired military people have said, look, they don't have the weapon, and it would be foolish of us to try and launch a preemptive strike against Iran.
Yes, and it's very interesting, too, that Netanyahu is starting to talk about having an election in Israel. And it occurred to me when I read that 2 days ago, that, in fact, they may not be actually thinking about launching a military strike against Iran, because how can you have an election plus, you know, a war?
Yes, I draw comfort from that, and I draw comfort from the thought that there are many intelligent, active, articulate Israelis who are warning against, quite sensibly warning against, an attack on Iran. And I just hope they prevail.
Mm. I would like at this point to bring up a study that was done by Physicians for Social Responsibility a few years ago. And because the uranium enrichment facilities at Nahant and Isfahan are so deeply buried, it would be very unlikely that a bunker buster, a conventional bomb, could so-called take out those facilities. So they conjured up the scenario that three nuclear weapons were dropped on the two uranium facilities at Nahant and Isfahan that would do the job of destroying the facilities. The resultant fallout from the release of huge quantities of uranium plus the radioactive elements from the nuclear explosions would, within the first 48 hours, killed 2.6 million people all the way over to Afghanistan, India and Pakistan. And it would also certainly affect Israel. And it's interesting to me that when the situation of, you know, taking out those facilities is discussed by Israel, and Obama says, you know, everything's on the table, so to speak, a military attack, the deaths of people is never entered into the equation.
That's right, I agree. Yes, and that's a very important element to mention, the multiplier effect of the fallout, not just from the bombs themselves, it's the enrichment facilities, if they got to them. Just imagine the amount of... it's like attacking a whole collection of nuclear power plants, isn't it?
Mm.
It's like Fukushima, and just imagine what could still happen there.
That's right. We've talked about Fukushima and your time in Japan. Well, would you like now to talk about your time as the ambassador in Mexico, but with specific reference to Cuba? You've been there.
I was ambassador to Cuba from Mexico, yes.
And the relationship of the United States with Cuba and how the Cubans feel about that, and what was your impression of the whole sort of diplomatic situation there?
I got to meet Fidel Castro, of course. I had dinner with him a couple of times. We were brokering an arrangement with an Australian mining company to mine bauxite from his own home province, and that led to quite a bit of negotiation. I knew the foreign minister very well, and I knew quite a lot of the cabinet, and the prevailing sense there was that they're quite sort of fatalistic about the American animosity. It would continue. They're also conscious and fatalistic about the anti-Castroites, the Cubans who are living in exile in Miami. But then, as they pointed out, that's always been the case. Whether it's Batista or anyone else, there's always going to be anti-regime people in the United States sort of wanting to have a coup against whoever was in control in Havana. Mm. I admire the health system that the Cubans have, their wonderful culture and ballet and their sporting achievements with boxing and other sports, their Olympic hopes, a country of enormous poverty but great pride. I must say a lot of people were very impatient with many of the more draconian laws about having private businesses, but that's been relieved. That's been relaxed a great deal in the last 5 to 10 years since Fidel's brother took over. It's a tough life, but the Cubans have an enormous amount of pride, and they're damned if they want to be dictated to by the United States. And they have allies and friends in Latin America. And I believe the last American conference of Latin American countries where Obama went, there's a great deal of antagonism and anger at the fact that Cuba had been excluded from this conclave, and they want them there. So I guess Cuba, it continues to have antiquated laws and it's not very economical, but the best way around that is for the United States to have some sort of rapprochement with them, and Cuba would again join the international community without fetters of the kind of sanctions that the United States imposed. When I went there, I pointed out to my government that it was really only the United States that were having these trade restrictions. When I was there on one visit, a big British and European trade mission came to town, and they were doing business with the Cubans like you wouldn't believe. Meanwhile, in Australia, we had a very profitable business selling sugar milling equipment to the Cubans from Queensland, but a company that was doing very well had been taken over by an American company, and therefore it fell under the American laws restricting trade with Cuba, and it went broke because it suddenly had no business with Cuba, its best customer. So, you know, Australia was suffering from this as well.
Yes.
But, yeah, unfortunately, Helen, we have in Canberra a government, whether it's Liberal or whether it's Conservative or Democratic, that seems to take its marching orders almost instinctively on foreign policy from Washington, which in my view is a very unhealthy situation.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And obviously, at the moment, with an election coming up in America, Obama cannot possibly afford to recognize Cuba, which would antagonize all the Cubans in Miami.
Of course, he's not likely to do it now, but he might.
He might do it after the election.
He might do it afterwards. That's our hope,
true.
Isn't it? Yes.
Now, as I look at your resume, you were also in Rangoon.
Yes.
Now that's Burma, now called Myanmar.
Myanmar.
But tell us what it was like to be in Rangoon. When were you there? And how repressive was it? And what about the generals who control the situation? And then give us a bit of a sort of a resume about what's happened since the time you were there. That would be fascinating too.
Well, I was there in 1970-71.
Yes.
And General Ne Win was in charge of the Burmese Socialist Program Party. It was a dictatorship run by the military. You'd see a fleet of Mercedes-Benz going in tight formation through the streets of Rangoon to their next meeting of the party. It was a very poor country, although not so poor. It was poor because of economic mismanagement, a bit like Cuba. In fact, Burma was relatively undamaged at the end of the Second World War, even though it had been fought over by the Japanese and between the Japanese and the British. But it was repressive, and Aung San, the famous leader, had been assassinated in 47 or 48. If he'd survived, there would have been a much greater spirit of national enterprise and development, in my view.
Yeah.
His daughter Aung San Suu Kyi is continuing the fight, and it seems that she might even be getting the generals to relent. But the point I wanted to make was there's hardly any difference, in my view, in the political situation in Burma in the early 70s to what it is now. The military are in control. They control all the trade. They have enormously effective intelligence around the country. So all the rebels, the Shan and the Mon and the Karen and the Kachins and the others are really compromised by the enormous widespread intelligence that the Burmese military have. And of course, the Burmese military, although they have committed frightful crimes, anti-democratic crimes against people who want Aung San Suu Kyi to be elected, they're supported by India and China and Thailand and other countries that want to have a part in the enormously rich extractive industries in Burma. And so while they've got the support of especially Beijing and New Delhi, the Burmese feel insulated, the military feel insulated and protected from any outside pressure to get them to change. Now, that might be changing because it seems that with Aung San Suu Kyi released from home arrest and now having a seat in Nyepi Dor, the new capital, in their parliament, it might lead to some, and hopefully it will lead to some sort of flexibility. But Hillary Clinton has said, of course, it's too early to make that judgment. We'll have to keep watching very carefully what happens in Burma. I personally continue to be pretty cynical. I think the military have such a good racket going that they're going to try and stay in control.
Yeah, I didn't understand why the military had such power and why there was such support for this very repressive, really ugly regime until I found out that, in fact, Burma is full of minerals and natural resources. Would you like to expand on that, Richard Bronowski?
Yes. Let me first say more about the military. UNU was the spiritual leader of Burma in a democratic situation after the end of the Second World War when the British gave independence to Burma in the 40s. And he was a very good man in many ways, but he was a hopeless administrator. And his administration, they couldn't, let's use a cliche from Italy, they couldn't make the trains run on time. And they couldn't clear the streets of rubbish in Rangoon.
Yeah.
And so he called on General Ne Win to come and take over and run a military operation for a while. He invited him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So General Ne Win and the army did, and they cleaned everything up. And then, as he said he would, General Ne Win relinquished control and allowed there to be new elections, and UNU won again. And yet he still couldn't control the party, he couldn't control the people or the various factions. So the next time General Ne Win took over Baku, and he said, all right, that's it. I'm not going to let these civilians run this place anymore. And so he took over and ran again an efficient military autocracy in Burma. The trouble was that the military became used to their own power, and they didn't want to give it up. They controlled the drug trade. They controlled the minerals. And coming to that, yes, Burma is full of rich timbers, tropical timbers, and rubies and various precious stones. And I think there's coal and a lot of minerals there as well, which the Chinese and the Indians are very interested in mining. It's a big country. It's as big as Thailand. And, you know, they've got huge geographical differences. There's a desert in Burma as well as enormous jungles. But the trouble is, you see, you've got the Burmans who live in the central Irrawaddy Valley, and then you've got all these other tribes around the outside, including the Christian Karen, which are along the Thai-Burmese border. And they've always been at war with the central government, and that will go on.
Yeah, it's very complex, isn't it? And, of course, America supported the General Ne Win and the military government too, hasn't it?
It has in the past. The Americans had a big embassy in Rangoon when I was there. The ambassador was a good friend of ours. He was influential in the councils of Rangoon. And, you know, the Americans were taking a supportive role. They had a big aid program. But the more the generals took over, the more anti-American they became. There's something very introspective about the Burman character. They're suspicious of foreign outside assistance or intervention. And, you know, they've got a sense of their own. They just want to be left alone. Right. They don't want to be involved in some great capitalist international activities. They want to run their own show.
Well, it might come from being colonised by the British in the first place.
Oh, that had a lot to do with it, the three Burman wars in the 18th century. I mean, yes, the Burmans were were taken over by the British, and the British East India Company exploited Burma. And Rangoon was the jewel of the British colonial system in Southeast Asia for a long time. And there's still signs, bare bones of that, bones in the city in Rangoon, geological buildings that were magnificent in their day. You know, there's a sense of nostalgia about the British Raj that you still see in Rangoon today.
Then there's Manila. You were also posted to the Philippines.
Oh, that was... Yeah, that was a very interesting time. I was there in the late. My wife was there with me as a diplomat. We were both serving there together. And it was in the mid to late 70s, and General Ne Win, President Marcos was running the country, and Imelda Marcos was buying shoes and singing songs and being very sentimental and being very vicious to her enemies. And the president was running the country under martial law. Of course, it had enormously, it had some great strengths from the American colonial period. Education in the Philippines has always been, I think, at least as good as anywhere else in Southeast Asia, and the standards of literacy and education have been very high. But yeah, they've been also blessed or cursed, depending where your beliefs lie, with having a very strong repressive Catholic Church. It was it was the result of 400 years of colonial Spanish colonial repression before the Americans came. So people say of the Philippines, no wonder they're confused. You know, 400 years in under the church and 50 years in Hollywood, they don't know who they are.
Well, but then there's the history of Subic Bay. You know, the Filipinos rose up and got rid of the Americans out of Subic Bay, which was just a festering sore on the landscape with prostitutes and all sorts of dreadful things happening. But I see now that the Americans have been welcomed back again into Subic Bay.
Well, I think it's a bit probably not quite accurate to say that the Filipinos rose up. What happened was both Clark Air Base and Subic Bay were major watering holes for the Americans, both maintenance and R&R, euphemistically rest and recreation centres. But then Mount Pinatubo blew up, the
volcano.
When that happened, they blanketed Clark and Subic with volcanic ash.
Yes.
And the Americans were really quite relaxed about getting out, and it wasn't so much the Filipinos rising up against them, although there's always been a sense of that they weren't very popular among certain quarters in the Philippines, although many Filipinos profited enormously from the American bases. So, yeah, it was a kind of a mutually agreed thing. And the Filipinos have never broken relations with the Americans. I think emotionally there's a very close connection between the United States and the Philippines. The Filipinos speak English with a kind of an American accent, and the American heritage is very strong there, traditions and as I said, education, values and systems.
Now, I particularly wanted to interview you, Richard, because of your recent interest and trip, in fact, to Fukushima, to correctly name
Fukushima.
It. Fukushima.
You put in equal emphasis, Helen, on each syllable. Fukushima.
Right. Fukushima.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you why you decided to go there. When did you go? How long were you there? And I've got some more questions.
Sure. Helen, I've always been interested in nuclear issues, just as you have. My first book was called Fact or Fiction, A History of Australian Interest in Nuclear Matters. When the Fukushima accidents catastrophe happened last year in March the 11th, I thought that immediately I was looking around for another book to write, and this seemed to be right. I have a background in Japan. I speak the language. I had a posting there for 3 years. My wife has had a posting there. Our daughter was born there. Our son speaks fluent Japanese and has just finished a PhD in Japanese theatre politics from the 1930s. I thought I'd like to go up there and see what is happening. As soon as the accident occurred, a great deal of disinformation was coming out of the Australian nuclear industry, especially the uranium miners, who were saying that this was not a problem, that it was a very minor accident, that no one would be injured or hurt or made ill by the radiation that was coming out of it, and it was all a big beat-up. And I was very indignant at that, and I thought, well, I need to go up and check for myself. So I did a lot of preparation, a lot of reading, and then in October last year, my wife and I went for 2 weeks to Japan. We spent a week in Tokyo just talking to a lot of senior people and various officials who I'd met before and I had through diplomatic contacts. And then we hired a car. We went on the Shinkansen train north to the province, the prefecture of Fukushima, and then we hired a car. And we first went to a very small town where there's a senior high school where I had some contacts. These were refugees from the coastal areas around which had been devastated by the tsunami. And there were other kids there as well. There was a very high level of anxiety about what was happening. This is about 30 kilometres southwest of the reactors. We also then, after interviewing those people, and it was quite heart-wrenching to do that because there's a lot of emotion involved. We went up to Fukushima City itself and saw a number of senior people at the university and officials. And then we went down to the coast with a guide, a Canadian Japanese Nisei, a second generation who spoke absolutely fluent Japanese, and my wife also speaks Japanese far better than I do, I must say. And we went down to the coast and we went to quite a number of villages north of the reactors. We were within the 30-kilometre radiation zone for a couple of days, and then we came out. I was concerned about radiation, but quite frankly, I'm far too old to breed, and I feel well if I've every year from now on as a bonus. So I picked up some invaluable information, and all that has been recorded, and I've added that to my book. And the book comes out, it's with the publisher now, and it comes out later this year, probably in about September or October.
And the book is being published by Scribe in Australia, and the name of the book?
We really don't have a name yet, Helen, but I think After Fukushima or Fukushima Fallout, or something like that. And then a subtitle would be National and International Implications for the Nuclear Industry.
Well, You've really had a fascinating career, haven't you? And although I'm your sister, because we were in different continents, I was in the US for much of the time that you were posted, and we didn't have an awful lot to do with each other. You've had an extraordinarily interesting life, haven't you?
I have indeed. Thank you. Yes.
And there's more to come.
I'm not out on the streets yet. That's important. I want to keep writing and keep sending our young Australian journalists to work in Asian newspapers. That's one thing I'm doing.
Yes, and seeing you're 72 today, you know,
thank you.
You might have another 20 years to go.
Who knows?
That would be very good, wouldn't it?
Or I might have 1 year to go. Who knows? It depends how you play it from now on.
Well, it depends how nature plays it, really.
That's right.
That's right. Well, look, it's been lovely to talk to you, Richard, and I'm sure the audience really appreciate hearing of your experiences and your knowledge about these very, very important countries and issues around the world.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking very much to you.
And thanks for coming on your 72nd birthday.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
On If You Love This Planet today, I've been speaking with Richard Bronowski, who's an author, an academic, a retired Australian diplomat, and my brother on his 72nd birthday. I hope you found this interesting, a lesson in history, modern diplomatic affairs, many things nuclear that are going on in the world in these various countries. I think it's very important for all of us to understand history, not just of our own country, but of the other countries in the world. So we'll be with you next week with another fascinating program, I'm sure. Listen to the program, encourage your friends to download it, get your local radio stations to play it, and if you would like to support us financially, which would be greatly and deeply appreciated, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org and there's a donate button there. Many thanks for listening, and we'll be with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.